Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the first life-size sculpture of Harriet Beecher Stowe is being unveiled at the Mandarin Museum and Historical Society.
She would have traversed this very acre.
We'll discuss the role of Fort Mitchell in the establishment of Alachua County.
When viewed in either military or political terms, the fort was a failure.
And we'll discuss the historic election of a female candidate in Florida 100 years ago. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. A life-size sculpture of Harriet Beecher Stowe teaching the ABCs to two young boys will be unveiled at the Mandarin Museum and Historical Society on Sunday, November 17th at 3 p.m. Harriet Beecher Stowe, best known for writing the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1852, spent her winters in Mandarin promoting tourism in the Sunshine State and encouraging progressive Northerners to move here. Sculptor Brenda Council grew up in Mandarin and was aware of Harriet Beecher Stowe's legacy.
Absolutely. As a teenager, when I first read Uncle Tom's Cabin, I think I was about 15, it made such an impact on me. I've never let it go. It was just an incredible book, an emotional experience. And it stayed with me my entire life. And growing up just off of Scott Mill Road, which intersects with the Grand Mandarin Road, I would ride my bike up and down Mandarin Road. And I would always pass the plaque, the historical plaque that is in place, signifying where her cottage was. And the community club was always a fixture. And so as I grew older, moved away from Mandarin to New York City. And I never forgot about Mandarin, though.
Harriet Beecher Stowe is known as an abolitionist and author, but she also focused on education. Stowe worked with the Freedmen's Bureau to set up a school primarily for the large African-American community in Mandarin. Sculptor Brenda Council.
As you know, the life of Harriet Beecher Stowe as she wintered in Florida was very impactful. When I think she actually picked Mandarin as a spot where she could begin her efforts after the war to help the population, particularly the Black community. And setting up the Freedmen's Bureau in 1872 was quite a feat in a Southern sympathizing area. When you read Palmetto Leaves, it gives such an expansive story of her winters here. And the concentration of what she did in the area. Fortunately, we have some of the landmarks that are here that we can physically see. But to me, it wasn't enough to have those edifices, those plaques. I wanted a physical manifestation of Harriet Beecher Stowe. And the only way to do that is to create a life-size sculpture.
Brenda Council's life-sized sculpture depicts Harriet Beecher Stowe sitting on a bench with two boys, one white and one African-American, sitting in front of her. Stowe is teaching them to read.
Although she was not a teacher, she did teach Sunday school in the community club, and she interfaced with the Black community continuously. and of course was a presence in the community. So I kind of visualized her 30 acres of orange groves. The laborers in those groves were underage, many of them. And I wanted to also touch on that dynamic in that context of history. So the way that I envision it, these young boys would have been coming in from the orange groves after a hard day's work. She would have intercepted them, and they're sitting on an upturned orange crate, and she takes a while, and she's sitting down with them with an ABC book, a book teaching them their ABCs. And maybe for the first time in their lives, they are scratching out their names on these little slates that she's given them. So they have chalk and slates in their hands, and they're following her instruction. And to me, it just created an intimate moment that could have happened. We don't have a historical record of this, but as you know, we artists, we can use artistic license.
The models for the figures in the sculpture came from the Mandarin community. Sculpting is not usually done as performance art, but people were able to watch Brenda Council work.
This was an idea that we collectively hatched, the Mandarin Museum Board and myself were thinking, well, wouldn't it be great if the community could really be involved in this, see the process from beginning to end. We archive and chronicle it day by day, really hour by hour. So we all agreed to do that. I moved my studio from North Carolina to Florida for 3 months and was housed in the historic Mandarin old store and post office. And sure enough, the crowds came. We were open only on the weekends, but I got a lot of work done, even being, in a fishbowl, essentially, because that's what people wanted to see was the sculpture at work. And from the beginning, I built the armature from wire and steel and epoxy. You know, today there are technologies where sculptors don't even have to build an armature. They can have it carved out of foam by a machine. And I said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do it the authentic, traditional way.
Following traditional methods, the clay models of Harriet Beecher Stowe and her two students became the basis for the bronze statue to be created.
That process is really intense. It hasn't changed in thousands of years. The mold process has changed a little bit, but a mold is made of the clay sculpture. And the clay I use is an oil-based clay. It never really dries out. So the mold is made out of latex. And then a ceramic shell is made out of that. And once the mold in the shell is made, wax is poured into the mold. That wax is then comes out of the mold. And then I go and look at the waxes and make sure that every detail is the way I want it. In most cases, it isn't. So I'm down there for 3 or 4 days at the foundry, burning the wax, heating it, and carving out details that have been lost in the mold process. That's called the lost wax process. After the wax is perfected, then it is dipped in another slurry, and it creates a very hard ceramic mold. And that is the mold that the bronze is poured into, 1800 degree bronze, which is 95% copper in most mixes. That is poured into the mold. The wax is still in there, but the wax quickly burns away and you have a bronze cast. and it's all in pieces. You know, my beautiful sculpture has been cut into pieces, so they have to weld it back together. They have to burnish it, chase it, finish it. And I'm down there during that process, still looking at every seam, make sure every fold is correct. And all the details in my sculpture are coming through the way I want it.
Brenda Council did not want her Harriet Beecher Stowe sculpture placed out of reach on a pedestal. She wants people to interact with Stowe sitting on the bench right next to her.
She would have traversed this very acre, and really to have an experience of closeness to her, to walk into the museum next door and learn more about her life and her impact here, and to see the faces on the boys, that they're happy for that moment in time. She has captured their attention. The most famous woman in the world is sitting down with these two young boys that don't understand class or place or anything. It's not in the context of their little lives. So hopefully it's a touching moment, and that people can really take away that little story, that narrative.
Brenda Council's life-sized sculpture of Harriet Beecher Stowe will be unveiled at the Mandarin Museum and Historical Society on Sunday, November 17th at 3 p.m. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, including the new episode on Fort Christmas. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the Florida landscape is dotted with military forts dating as early as the Spanish period, but few Floridians are aware of Fort Mitchell, a Patriot War fort situated in Alachua County and designated as the capital of the Republic of East Florida.
Fort Mitchell has largely been forgotten because, as Chris Monaco states in his summer 2000 article in the Florida Historical Quarterly, quote, when viewed in either military or political terms, the fort was a failure, end quote. Erected as a 25-foot square, two-story blockhouse in January 1814, it had been abandoned by May of the same year. Noteworthy as the first substantial Anglo-American settlement in the interior of Spanish East Florida, it was intended as the nucleus of a self-sustaining long-term agricultural colony. As Monaco explains in his article titled Fort Mitchell and the Settlement of Alachua County, while initially a failure, the agricultural potential of the area brought the former Patriot War rebels back to the region after 1821, when Florida was ceded to the United States, where many of them achieved positions of prominence, becoming sheriffs, judges, militia officers, and legislators. In posing this interpretation of war and the militia men who fought it, Monaco challenges the view of historians, including Rembert Patrick, quote, who portrayed the Patriots as anti-social scoundrels, end quote. Monaco argues that the militiamen were soldier settlers who, before taking up arms, were yeoman farmers or engaged in the lucrative lumber business along the St. Mary's River. As he defines them, they expressed, quote, patriotic and expansionist sentiments generated by the War of 1812 and acted on promises of generous Florida land grants, end quote. Inspired by these sentiments, quote, Georgia frontiersmen joined the volunteer force that gathered to seize East Florida from the Spanish, end quote.
Connie, although the area where Fort Mitchell would be established was well known to the Patriots, the exact site of the fort soon became lost to history.
Correct on both counts. The fort was reportedly located on or close to a large prairie, 7 or 8 miles wide and 20 miles long. A letter from the Patriot leader, General Buckner Harris, to Thomas Pinckney located the blockhouse near Payne's former residence, a reference to Paynestown, the head village of the Alachua Band of Seminoles and the residence of King Payne. A close scrutiny of the maps of the Spanish Arredondo grant and the careful work of the University of Florida archaeologists confirmed the location of the village north of Micanopy. The choice of location for the Patriot Fort was likely intentional. The site was well known to the militiamen. In February 1813, Tennessee militiamen and federal troops marched into Payne's Prairie to confront the Seminoles in response to an earlier Seminole offensive that ended the Patriot ambitions to capture the fortress of Castillo San Marcos in St. Augustine. In the 1814 foray, the Georgia soldiers found the Seminole villages abandoned, burned the remains of the town, and constructed Fort Mitchell, named for the former governor of Georgia and U.S. Commissioner David Mitchell. Control over Payne's Prairie would fulfill the land dreams of the soldiers. As Monaco explains, quote, "The Seminole economy prior to 1812 differed little from prosperous Anglo-American hamlets in the frontier South. The Alachua Seminoles, like the Creeks, built substantial cabin dwellings, and agricultural coexisted with increasing dependence on free-range cattle." As Monaco explains, quote, "The Alachua Seminoles, once known as the most wealthy of American tribes, sold cattle to the trading houses of Panton, Leslie, and Company, which had exclusive rights to all Indian trade," end quote. According to one Patriot officer, "The cattle were as fat as I ever saw." Harris wrote to Pinckney that should the United States decide to annex the District of Alachua, there would be no problem supplying the army with beef of the best quality. These farmer soldiers also recognized the rich soils of Alachua that were far superior to those of wiregrass country of South Georgia. As one officer wrote, quote, "The Alachua County excels any I have ever seen," end quote. The soils, combined with the mild climate, foretold long and productive growing seasons. The settler soldiers justified their anticipated appropriation of the Seminole land by assuming the natural superiority of Anglo-American civilization to develop the land and criticize the inability of Indians to properly cultivate and manage the gift that God had bestowed on all his rational creatures. As proper cultivators, patriots were merely doing God's will and adhering to his commands. Neither Seminole nor Spanish claims deterred the Americans. Justifying the invasion of Spanish Florida under revolutionary concepts of natural rights and the pursuit of liberty for those living under the Spanish yoke, the 105 men at Fort Mitchell drafted a petition to Congress to recognize the District of Alachua in the Republic of East Florida as a United States territory. After a lengthy delay, President James Madison denied the petition. Although Rembert Patrick dismissed the petitioners in general and Buckner Harris in particular as men of poor character, Monaco points to Harris's service as a veteran of the Revolutionary War and his family ties to Georgia and U.S. political figures as evidence that the men who invaded Florida were not the scoundrels depicted by Patrick and other historians. Harris was recognized by those who followed him as the guiding force for the venture, and when, in May, he was ambushed and killed, the scheme fell apart.
Connie, although almost everyone there returned to Georgia, the end of Fort Mitchell was not the last we would hear from the soldiers.
Monaco challenges Patrick's description of the former Patriots as, quote, "wanderers who sought seclusion in the sparsely populated Florida frontiers," end quote, by pointing out that almost half of the men returned to Florida after the Spanish cession to the U.S. Moreover, a few never left. Of the 105 recorded citizens at Fort Mitchell, at least 42 settled in Florida, 24 in Alachua County. A brief survey of some of the settlers shows that they serve their local and state governments as sheriffs, judges, and legislators. The Dell brothers, James, Maxie, and Simeon, founded Noonansville, now Alachua, and named the town for Daniel Noonan, a Patriot War hero. Noonansville became the largest settlement in interior East Florida and served as the county seat. In 1827, Simeon Dell was appointed the county's first sheriff. In 1829, James served in the Legislative Council of Florida. Maxie established the area's first Methodist church and became a prominent planter and miller. Francis Sanchez served as Justice of the Peace and was appointed judge of Alachua County Court. He lived on his ranch some 4 miles outside Noonansville. The site is now a 6,500-acre state wildlife preserve. Jacob Summerlin lived in the area of the present Lake City. His son Jake moved into central Florida, where he became a noted cattleman. Patriot Captain William Cone represented Columbia County in the Legislative Council and in 1854 was elected as a state senator. John Houston McIntosh, the first director of the Territory of East Florida, was a wealthy sugar planter near the eponymous town of McIntosh. Monaco concludes by pointing out the irony that as older, more established, and respectable efforts to control the land and settlement of the Alachua area failed, quote, the new emerging leadership was the very group whose character and honor has traditionally been the most maligned, end quote.
An interesting history. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. There was an historic election of a female candidate in Florida 100 years ago. Sandra Averhart from WUWF in Pensacola has more.
The story of Fanny Salmons begins in Bowling Green, Kentucky, where she was born around 1892. When she was a young girl, Salmon's father, Frank, a railroad engineer, moved the family to Pensacola, where they settled in the East Hill area.
She grows up in the city, moves to Selma for a little bit in her late teens, early 20s.
Picking up the story is Dr. Jamin Wells, an associate professor of history at the University of West Florida.
She came back and took a job as a reporter for the Pensacola News, which was the evening paper here in Pensacola.
Salmons came of age during the women's suffrage movement, which culminated with the 1920 passage of the 19th Amendment.
Yeah, so we don't know if Fanny herself was actively engaged, but she grew up in a community in Pensacola that was very engaged in the women's suffrage movement, led by Celia Myover Robinson, a fellow reporter. They brought in speakers, there was regular columns in the newspaper advocating for it, and so she grew up in this ferment supporting women's suffrage. I have no doubt inspired her to later run for the office.
She announced her run for Escambia County Commission in the spring of 1924.
She was one of just 6 women in the entire state of Florida to run for an elected position that year. It was very uncommon, even though it was 4 years after women were granted the right to vote, for women to run for office. And so Fanny was one of a handful. 3 of those 6 were elected in 1924, and she was the only county commissioner in the whole state and the first woman elected to represent District 1 of Escambia County.
And notably, Salmons beat out 7 men for the seat.
My name's Mary Bogart Waltersdorf, and I am Fanny Salmons Bogart's granddaughter.
Waltersdorf lives in Pace.
She was bold. Obviously a very forward person for her time, running against 7 men in 1924 to do what she did. That took a lot of guts.
Waltersdorf was born 1 year after Salmons died in 1957, so she never knew her grandmother. But she heard stories and has learned a lot by digging through family archives.
Politics and politicians. This is hard to read because there's tape all over it. I knew that she was the first woman county commissioner, but she sold real estate. And also, I didn't realize that she was such a writer.
In addition to Salmon's work for the Pensacola News, she wrote many poems. One of them was featured in the 2005 UWF Florida Humanities Council project, Collard Greens and Artistic Scenes, Stories of Pensacola Women of the 1930s.
A Fisherman's Widow by Fanny Salmons Bogart, Pensacola's first female county commissioner, July 14, 1934.
This excerpt read by Deanie Harmon.
I do not like the slimy things that swim in the waters blue. I do not like to bait a hook nor dote upon a catch or two. So I'm a fisherman's widow.
Fisherman's Widow was written about Salmon's husband, William Bogart, whom she married in 1925 after taking her District 1 seat.
She came into office on January 1st, 1925, and served for 2 years in that position. She was in charge of the county courthouse and the jail.
Again, Dr. Jamin Wells. He says Salmons also concentrated on the building of roads and bridges.
Some of the iconic roads of Escambia County are constructed during this time, including Scenic Highway, Palafox, connecting downtown to Alabama, as well as the two bridges that connected downtown to the beaches.
Despite the work she was getting done, Salmons Bogart decided not to seek re-election, although she remained active in civic organizations.
She was fondly remembered when she passed away in 1957, the age of 65, as someone who was successful, a successful politician and leader in Escambia County, and one to be remembered and emulated, as the paper described her.
Salmons Bogart carried the mantle of being the only woman elected to the Escambia County Commission for more than six decades, until Muriel Wagner won the District 4 seat in 1986. Waltersdorf says it was almost 20 years after that when board members finally adopted a resolution properly honoring her grandmother.
Yes, we were at the county commission meeting when they recognized her to put her picture on the wall.
Where it belongs, beside other commissioners in Escambia County's history. It was a special moment, she says.
It really was very special.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sandra Averhart, WUWF Pensacola.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and this week, Sandra Averhart. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.